how the music of sinners found its way into the home of saints. This is Soundcheck. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta in for John Schaefer. Today on the show, the rock and roll roots of contemporary Christian music. And later, a live performance from Irish songstress and composer Julie Feeney. But first, in the background, you're hearing Sweet Song of Salvation. Actually, Sweet, Sweet Song of Salvation from the 1969 album Upon This Rock by singer Larry Norman. The Christian rock pioneer became one of the counterculture, one of the most recognized voices within the Jesus movement of the late 1960s and 1970s. It was a counterculture that resulted in an unprecedented acceptance of modern music inside church walls. Joining me now from Michigan State University is Professor David Stowe, author of the new book, No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
David, I think we need to establish first off, what was the Jesus Movement? How did it start and when did it start?
Well, the Jesus Movement was a kind of spin-off of the hippie counterculture of the late 1960s that sort of reached out to burned-out hippies on the streets of San Francisco, the Bay Area, in basically beginning about the Summer of Love, 1967, and then into the late 60s, and migrated down to Orange County to Costa Mesa, where there was a big evangelical church called Calvary Chapel that just made an incredible splash by attracting all sorts of teenagers, evangelicals, kids who had been hippies and burned out and suddenly were finding Jesus. So it's really a West Coast-based movement that suddenly begins to get all this national attention in 1971. It's on the cover of Time magazine, Life magazine, Look magazine are covering it. And so it had been taking shape for a few years, but suddenly it becomes a media phenomenon.
And was Larry Norman a part of that movement?
Yeah, very much a part of the movement. He was in on the cutting edge. He is considered to have made really the first Christian rock album in 1969, Upon This Rock. And he was based in the West Coast and was a street evangelist in Hollywood on and off during these years. So he never really considered himself part of the Jesus movement. He was too much of a renegade individualist to really be part of a movement, but he certainly had a huge musical impact.
Now, draw a picture for us, because I'm curious to know how the hippies and, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll people who were hanging out in California back at that time came together with this guy, Chuck Smith, who I understand was, you know, rather a conservative, straight up laced guy. How did the two of those very different kinds of people and lifestyles come together?
Well, he had this small church, mainstream Pentecostal church in Orange County, and he just became aware of these young people that he considered to be in need, young hippies, people who had lost their direction, had burned out on sex and drugs. And it was actually his wife that suggested, you know, Chuck, why don't we see if we can reach these young people? And so he then made a very important personal connection through one of his kids, and he had a number of kids in that age group, so he was exposed to their friends. It wasn't like he was living apart from youth culture. Mm-hmm. But he had a young man named Lonnie Frisbee show up, who was a friend of one of his kids. And Frisbee was this, you know, quintessential Jesus freak from California. He'd been tripping on acid on the streets of Haight-Ashbury, sort of rambling, ranting about Jesus coming out of a flying saucer. So he was one of these people that was reached in San Francisco. He made his way down to Orange County, and so Chuck Smith realized this guy has real potential because he Frisbee had become born again, and he was this incredibly charismatic, dynamic youth pastor, and he looked exactly like Jesus. I mean, he had the long hair, the beard. He was essentially interchangeable. So he was really the man on the ground at Calvary Chapel who was able to to really speak the language of the young people that Chuck Smith was trying to reach. So Chuck was kind of this older guy, football coach, kind of avuncular figure, but the guy who was really exciting the young folks was Lonnie Frisbee.
I got to ask you, Frisbee, was that his real name?
that was his real name.
Really? Very interesting.
Yeah.
So he kind of was the link that brought together these two groups.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you know, at that time in the 60s, it wasn't uncommon to hear Christian themes in pop music. Can you talk about that? Was that kind of part of this, or was that just separate? How does that play into it? I know that Larry Norman opened for bands like the Grateful Dead, Hendrix, Doors, the Byrds. So how did they embrace this Christian theme in the music?
Right. It's a strange thing that by the late 60s, the top 10 songs, you know, top 40 radio is full of these songs that casually mention Jesus, you know, sort of drop him into the lyrics. Sweet Baby James, Mrs. Robinson. So there's a number of hits beginning around 1967. The Young Bloods have this song Come Together that seem to be alluding to a quasi-Christian or at least a religious message. And, you know, these were secular artists. They didn't really have any connection to the church, but somehow the figure, the image of Jesus was seen as being compelling in some way. Mm-hmm. And so as the decade turned into the 1970s, this really bursts on to the popular stage through Jesus Christ Superstar, which is written by a couple of Englishmen, right, who are, again, not evangelicals.
You know, before we get to that, because I want to jump back. I know we're going to hit the 70s, but I know in 65, Barry McGuire had a big hit with Eve of Destruction. Can you talk about Barry McGuire's kind of entry point into Christian music and spreading the Christian sound? What was he thinking about when he wrote Eve of Destruction?
Well, he didn't actually write that song. That was written by a young songwriter named P.F. Sloan, and the song was offered to some other artists, but McGuire was the one who recorded it, and it went on to be a number one hit, even though it was basically boycotted by radio stations. It was considered too controversial. So I think McGuire really fits in this interest in the end times, the apocalypse. I mean, you find this very strongly in some of the early music of Bob Dylan, who's, you know, writing songs that are kind of drenched in biblical themes. But, you know, it's part of the whole Cold War fear that, you know, the world is headed towards a nuclear Armageddon. And, you know, there's this war breaking out all around. Of course, the nation is getting immersed in Vietnam. So the sense that things can't continue on too long. So McGuire makes this song, which it's not a religious or Christian song in any way. It's a secular version of the end of times. And then he goes on to have this interesting career in the musical Hair, actually plays the lead role on Broadway for a while. But then he's born again in 1971, again this year when suddenly everyone's hearing a lot about the Jesus movement.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Barry McGuire's pre-Jesus movement, 1965 apocalyptic hit, Eve of Destruction.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
We're talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. He's the professor of English and Religious Studies at Michigan State University. And I'm Jacqueline Sincotta, in for John Schaefer today on Soundcheck. David, can you describe what was happening in the churches before this kind of pop music started to get integrated? What was going on, and how were youth reacting or not reacting to that?
Well, churches are beginning to experiment a little bit with more contemporary sounding music. I mean, basically, churches had been singing the four-part traditional hymns, many of which date back to the 1700s and 1800s. And so by the 1960s, you've got the Catholic Church is involved in Vatican II, which opens the door up to more contemporary music. We see folk masses coming into Catholic churches. And some churches are putting on Christian youth musicals in an attempt to try to get a little more interesting, a little more contemporary music to young people. Now, that's not being performed on Sunday morning. Those are youth groups. But basically, music is very traditional organ music, organ and piano. You have some of the Pentecostal churches that allow, you know, drums and tambourines and other instruments, but there's basically no sound of contemporary rock and roll being heard in the churches until things start to give way about 1970-71. And, you know, you've got this baby boom generation that is very committed to its music. Even Christians who don't really have much sympathy for anything else about the youth culture often love the music. So they want to hear that in their churches.
And as we head to 1971, there's an interesting story of Marcia Stevens, who kind of hooked up with Chuck Smith. Now, she was the daughter of a preacher who had a history of molesting kids in his congregation, and an alcoholic mother. So she came from a really difficult situation, but yet still she seemed to be drawn to Chuck and to the music. And can you talk a little bit about her and her band and her first song?
Yeah, she was someone that I had the privilege of interviewing, spending quite a few hours talking with, and I just found her a really fascinating person and a life story. But, you know, she was a teenager. She was 16 when she got involved in Calvary Chapel, and she was one of those kids that actually got baptized in the Pacific Ocean off of Costa Mesa, you know, and that's the great image of the Jesus movement is hundreds, thousands of kids in the surf,
right,
being dunked in the ocean. So, but she was fairly typical in having this very sort of tormented family life. I mean, they were a middle class family, but they had this very dark secret in the family. So she was apparently, you know, really getting mixed up in some rough behavior and was saved. Her sister was, you know, quote unquote saved, and they were musically inclined. So they founded this group, basically a Jesus folk group called Children of the Day. So the two sisters and their two boyfriends who they went on to marry. And this became one of the favorite early Christian rock groups to come out of Calvary Chapel. And what's interesting about her was after a few years touring in the Christian rock business, she and her husband, the pressure got to them. They decided to get divorced. And then shortly afterwards, Marcia came out as a lesbian. Okay, so the divorce was shocking enough, but coming out as a lesbian was really unthinkable. And so she was basically drummed out of the Christian music business. I mean, her songs were torn out of songbooks that they were in. But the amazing thing to me is that she's basically maintained her theology. She still considers herself a loyal evangelical. She continues to make music to tour around, and there are now churches that will and other places where she can play.
Well,
but she has no bitterness, and so it's interesting.
Yeah, well, we're talking to David Stowe. He's the author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. Let's hear a little bit of that song from Children of the Day, Marcia Stevens' band, For Those Tears I Died, on Soundcheck.
Come to the water, stand by my side.
I'm Jacqueline Sincotta in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck today, talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. That's Children of the Day, one of the popular songs in the early part of that movement from a band called Children of the Day. Listeners, we would like to hear from you. Were you a witness to the Jesus movement and its music? What did you think about Jesus music when it first came on the scene? Did you even recognize it in albums like Jesus Christ Superstar and so many others that had come out? Leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at wnyc.org/soundcheck. And David, speaking of musicals, there was an incredible religious crossover into mainstream culture through musicals, Godspell, Jesus Christ. Tell us more about that.
Well, there were these very small-scale Christian musicals in the churches, but then Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber were very young, early 20s. They really hadn't established a name for themselves, and so they wrote this rock opera in England, and then they released the single in this country. It got some radio play, and the big album followed in 1970. It was at the top of the charts, and then exactly 40 years ago this spring, the musical was being prepared for Broadway. So suddenly, you know, this life story, the Jesus life story, is the most visible, you know, musical form of popular culture. Well, I won't say the most visible, but very popular in the 1970s. Godspell comes out of Pittsburgh. It's, again, written by a young graduate student, and opens, again, exactly 40 years ago to this month off-Broadway. So you've got these two retellings of the life of Jesus coming out at exactly the same time, that the Jesus movement is attracting all this attention on the West Coast, and there are all these other songs in the top 40s. So, you know, it does seem like a sort of amazing year. And, of course, you know, the film Jesus Christ Superstar follows in 1973.
Well, you know, let me ask you, though, how did the Jesus movement receive these religious crossover musicals? Did they welcome it? Were they wary of it?
Well, they liked Godspell pretty well because Godspell pretty much stuck to the words of Scripture. Almost all the words in the show are directly out of the Gospel of Matthew. But Jesus Christ Superstar was a lot more controversial because it shows this more human, this more mortal, so to speak, side of Jesus, the fact that he might have had some sort of amorous relationship with Mary Magdalene. The sense that at the end of the show, I mean, he's not resurrected, right? He's crucified, and that's the way it ends. So I think many conservative Christians had reservations about the way the story is told. They didn't really feel like it was a part of their movement. But on the other hand, I think some of them liked the music. I mean, they couldn't deny that there was some great music there. And I think some people took the attitude.
And it certainly was opening up the path for a lot of people to kind of dip their feet in the water and hear some of this Christian music. Let's actually hear a little bit of the original 1970 concept album, Jesus Christ Superstar, by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. This is Superstar. Why you let the things you did get so out of hand? You'd have managed better if you'd had it planned. Why'd you choose such a backward time on such a strange land? If you'd come today, you would have reached the whole nation. Israel in 4 BC had no mass communication. Don't get me wrong. 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 I wanna know. I wanna know. I wanna We're talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. We're talking about the Jesus Movement music, and we will talk more. But first up next, we'll continue our conversation and with about the rock roots of contemporary Christian music, and then multi-talented Irish singer and composer Julie Feeney joins us live in the studio. This is Soundcheck. Sorrows and bid you mourning and kicks back to the day's end. Now you're done with love. You're not looking for love for his boring friend. This is Soundcheck. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta, in for John Schaefer. We continue our discussion now about the roots of contemporary Christian music, a genre which is firmly rooted in the Jesus movement of the late 1960s and 1970s. Around the same time, however, religious themes were popping up in music across the charts. Right now, Marvin Gaye's God is Love is what you're hearing in the background from his 1971 album, What's Going On. Michigan State professor David Stowe is the author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. He joins me again. David, welcome back. Let's talk about gospel. How does gospel and soul fit into this whole scenario that's going on?
Gospel music is a huge source of the energy of contemporary Christian music and church music in general. And so, you have this sort of division of the black church and black church music, and then you've got the white churches. And what happens is with the interest in making music more contemporary, more listenable, you have these young musicians drawing on more black and African American sounds in their music. But I mean, frankly, the Jesus movement is by and large a white movement. And there's not too many African American artists that really play a major role in those early years in the late 60s, early 70s. Andre Crouch is the big exception. He's someone who grows up in the Pentecostal church in L.A., Kojic, it's called, and goes on to have this phenomenal career and really is a crossover artist, gets a lot of Jesus freaks interested in kind of soul Jesus music. But then you have artists who are really dominating the charts, secular artists like Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Al Green, and so forth, who, come out of the black church, really learn how to sing and are shaped by the experiences of gospel music. And they never really leave those traditions behind. So you've got an artist like Marvin Gaye with his great concept album we were just listening to, who's, he's not an evangelical and he's not really considered part of that movement, but he's still drawn to some of the same themes and images. And you find this with Aretha Franklin and Stevie Wonder to a small degree, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
So was there animosity between the two groups, the folks like Aretha, Marvin, and Stevie, and the Jesus movement music?
No, I don't think so. I think they were kind of in parallel universes for the most part. They weren't mm-hmm. they weren't really speaking to each other very much. I think Andre Crouch is really the only, black artist who's really accepted and recognized as part of the Jesus movement.
And then there's Bob Dylan. In the late 1970s, he became a born-again Christian. Earlier on from his album Slow Train Coming, he had a really popular a song. Talk to us a little bit about Bob Dylan's role in all of this Christian music in his early years.
Right. Well, Bob Dylan is someone who, again, even though he's Jewish, he's shaped by biblical language. You can find it a lot in his early songs like Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and so forth. And so that's part of his sort of source material for his great songwriting. But by 1978, he's gone through a rough decade in the 1970s, professionally, musically, personally. And so he's at the place that a lot of these artists end up being that I write about in my book, which is artists who have enjoyed this kind of fame, celebrity, material success, but are sort of wasted and wiped out by the sort of demands it has. So he has a born-again experience in 1978. And people are sort of amazed by it. And then he goes on to record these three albums where it's unmistakable that he's voicing these themes.
And one of them was Slow Train Coming, which had the hit Gotta Serve Somebody. We're going to hear another song from that album. This is Bob Dylan, When He Returns, from 1979's Slow Train Coming.
The strongest war will crumble and fall to a mighty God. For all those who have eyes and all those who have ears, it is only He who can reduce me to tears. Cry, and don't you die, and don't you burn like a thief in the night. He'll replace wrong with right when He returns.
Bob Dylan's When He Returns from 1979's Slow Train Coming. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta in for John Schaefer on Soundcheck today. We're talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music, and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. David, we only have about a minute left. We talked a lot about the history. Can you put all of this in context for us with where the contemporary Christian music movement is now?
Well, contemporary Christian music called CCM is now one of the biggest genres out there of popular music. It sells roughly as many recordings as jazz, classical, and New Age combined. So it's definitely been a huge success story since the 1970s. The music has really filtered into the churches, into worship, in a very day-to-day way through praise music, which is basically contemporary Christian music arranged for congregations to sing along. So in that sense, this music has really shaped the way large numbers of Americans experience worship. And in the book, I make an argument about the impact of the evangelicals on American politics. So basically, I'm arguing that this music really kept people in the churches, where they often received a somewhat conservative message, and that this, in effect, has really reshaped American politics, moved the United States in a more conservative direction. Not that the lyrics are explicitly political, but they've had an impact on how people worship and how many people worship.
David, I want to thank you for joining us. I've been talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music, and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. And the song that inspired the title of David Stowe's book, No Sympathy for the Devil, we couldn't possibly do this segment without giving you a taste of that. Thanks again, David.
Oh, my pleasure, Jacqueline. Thanks for having me.
Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his face.
The Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil, from 1968, their hit song. We've been talking with David Stowe, author of No Sympathy for the Devil, Christian Pop Music, and the Transformation of American Evangelicalism. Up next, Irish singer and composer Julie Feeney performs songs from her newest album, Pages. And don't forget, tickets for our next event in WNYC's Green Space are now on sale. Four great artists will perform on Soundcheck's Mic Check, our showcase of local hip-hop. Catch sets from the new stars like The Freeze Tag and Nitty Scott MC, plus two underground heroes, Queens MC Homeboy Sandman, and this Brooklyn-based rapper and drummer, Blitz the Ambassador, and his seven-piece band. It's all taking place in the Green Space on June 9th at 8 o'clock in the evening. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
Mr. Roving Eye Guy found a haven to protect him from rejection. Nothing brought in or out from there. Dancing girls dressed up as romance, aesthetically pleased, pretend romance.
This is Soundcheck. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta, in for John Schaefer. Irish composer and singer Julie Feeney has a thing for royal wedding-worthy headpieces. And musically, she's a wearer of many hats as well. Her resume includes stints as a professional singer, river dance performer, composer, and model. Oh, and by the way, she also has three master's degrees, including one in psychoanalysis. But for now, she's focusing on her music. Her newest album, Pages, has just been released in the United States. Before we talk a bit with her about the new album, this is Julie Feeney and her band playing the song Monster live on Soundcheck.
Shook the beautiful tree before it. You shook, 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 shook. Fascinated by the charm of a beautiful and delicate thing, dazzled by its beauty. If you forget, you know what lies within, and you forget, you know what lies within. Shook, shook, the beautiful tree before it. You shook, 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 shook. The beautiful tree needs to be preened, an elegant daily tending. But the power is known, a monster's grown, and stirred for fear of what might be pending, and stirred for fear of what might be pending. Shake the tree, the contents down will fall. And for a pretty tree, the contents aren't treated that very pretty at all. Aren't treated that very pretty at all.
That was Julie Feeney with her band performing the song Monster live on Soundcheck. Now, we've got a great group of people in here. Let me quickly call out who we have. Julie Feeney, of course, vocals and recorder. Jennifer Marshall doing backing vocals. Cormac DeBarra on harp and vocals. David Baranowski playing piano and keyboard. Katie Miller, trumpet, backing vocals. And Liz Carey playing violin. Well, Julie, you certainly do have an impressive collection of hats, including the one that you, the little headpiece, would you call that a hat that you're wearing now? I see it has a sewing motif of buttons and needles. And
yeah, I believe there's some kind of name. It's meant to be a fascinator, but I'm not quite so sure. My friend just made it out of vintage buttons. She's just my friend, and I just love wearing headpieces, but we've got the Galway races in Ireland, and people wear all kinds of hats that I normally don't like. Mm-hmm. So I prefer to have different kinds of hats that you wouldn't wear at the Galway races.
So exactly where does this rank as radical in your world?
As in not wearing the right headpiece at a Galway race. It's not really a radical thing at all. It's just a preference. You'd have to go to the Galway. You should come to Galway and
yeah,
you can check out what I mean. It's a lot of kind of frilly things, and I prefer kind of vintage buttons and things like that.
Does wearing, I know that you often wear some of your many hats at your performances. What does that bring to it for you?
In the case of the house that I wear, I had a house painted in particular colours for the artwork for the album. It's a house in Galway. And I then have that replicated as a headpiece. It's an easy way to have your backdrop instead of having to have all the technology. But it also creates a world for me. And I do like now on this album, I like to create the world that the album is. So I like to step into that world. So it's a very much, that's why I wear costumes and all of that. I just like to create a show with all of that in it. It's it is part of a character, because I worked so much on the music and the orchestrations and the conducting and all of that. I like to have an escape even just for myself so I can go into this other world, because it's all very kind of nerdy and a bit intense and insanely I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so it's quite hard, you know, when you're dealing with stuff like that. So it's nice to have a fantasy time.
I want to let our listeners know they can see the hat that we're talking about on our website, wnyc.org/soundcheck, where you'll also have a link to one of the videos that Julie Feeney performs, where you'll see a plethora of your fabulous hats as well in the video for Impossibly Beautiful. You know, I want to talk a moment before we play the next song about how you feel about New York. You have another great video on your website that's just called New York Video. And I know you shot it back in January when you were here last time. And I do want to quickly mention that Julie Feeney and her band will be performing tonight at Joe's Pub at 9:30 if you want to see her live. But that video, the soundtrack is actually a mix of two of your songs. One of them is Grace and the other Impossibly Beautiful. What is it about New York? What inspired that video? It's a beautiful black and white, lush video.
Yeah, New York is definitely a place that I've always wanted to live. Instinctively, I've always just known. It was a gut feeling. As a very talented young Irish director, Miles O'Reilly, was floating around in Ireland, and I just thought that I would ask him to come for me to film my favourite city in the world, to do a show. So it's black and white. It's his own particular style. And he films the rehearsals and all of that. So it's Julie Feeney, New York. New York, I think it's on my website anyway. Mm-hmm. But I just adore the city, and I'm not sure whether it's not people in my family might have come here generations before. I haven't fully worked that out. I do have an uncle who lives here, and I have cousins in the New York Philharmonic who are here as well. But aside from that, I do feel there's a natural instinctive thing that I can't even describe about New York. It's just it's exactly the right kind of people, the exact cross-section of people. I'm really trying to work out a way of coming here.
Well, I think if you're interested in seeing that, we'll have a link to it on our website. It's a beautiful homage to New York City. And while we're talking about Grace, the first song of that video, and Impossibly Beautiful, the song that kind of comes out of that video, why don't we hear Impossibly Beautiful? This is Julie Feeney and her band live on Soundcheck.
I know not your heart, ye mind ye nay, your Achilles heel or from where you came. Though it's written in the stars, my desires will flame. I might take a pass on what the stars are saying, cause you're impossibly beautiful. Is that cause I'm waiting? Is that cause I'm looking? Or is it just cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that cause I'm waiting? Is that cause I'm looking? Or is it just cause you are? The indignant look as you catch the eye, of the unlooker caught in a gaze at thine. As you're innocently floating your beauty up, you've no idea how beautiful you are, 'cause you're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Or is it just 'cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Or is it just 'cause you are? You're not laid so bare by the Vanity Fair to tamper with your charms, oxygen in a jar. You're not an assembled cocktail of bits and not a stuck together look all made up with tricks, 'cause you're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Is it just 'cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Is it just 'cause you are? You don't play the love game of toxic love, trading love for beauty, the winning of. Will you ever wish you knew what a spell you cast? Maybe it's a beauty you'll always have, 'cause you're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Is it just 'cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Or is it just 'cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Or is it just 'cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that 'cause I'm waiting? Is that 'cause I'm looking? Or is it just 'cause you are?
That is Julie Feeney and her band live on Soundcheck performing Impossibly Beautiful. Julie will be at Joe's Pub tonight at 9:30. And your new album, Pages, your second, was just released in the U.S. yesterday, I understand.
That's right. It's very exciting,
very
actually.
Very exciting. And now that was released in Ireland a few years ago, but it's first coming here. Is that, did
first
I get
coming
that right?
Here. People are often afraid to come to America, but I've always had an inkling. I've always wanted to come here because people, I think, are a bit afraid of how big it is and all of that. But I think when you've got, well, you've got New York, I'm just ecstatic to have come here. And I actually was a recipient of an award we have. It's Imagine Ireland. It's an initiative which enabled me to first do a tour, mm-hmm. Which gave me tour support. I obviously had to fund the rest of it with my own label, Mittens. But the fact that I was able to come here was just so brilliant. So it is out in America, and I'm really, really excited, and I want to start coming over and over. But the audiences grow here as well. It's really, you find that more and more people come each time. You're very kind.
That's
of,
what you want, right?
Yeah, but they do that.
Tell us, where did the name Pages come from?
It took me about 3 weeks, a really head-wrecking 3 weeks, because it's really funny how the name is so important. I could have gotten it so wrong. It could have easily sounded very pretentious. It's easy to sound pretentious when it's all very nerdy, the rest of it. So I wanted to kind of, it's like a fairy tale story, that sort of dog-eared book, fairy tale mm-hmm. book that you have when you're age six that you love the smell of and you love the look of. So I wanted the album to be kind of like that. So that's what the coloured house and the videos with all the colour. I wanted colour there. So Pages is really a fairy tale book.
And I know there's an interesting story behind where you wrote the songs for this. Can you tell us quickly about that?
I went to an artist retreat up in Anna McCarrick in County Monaghan. I just locked myself away for 6 weeks. I just had a personal thing that happened with somebody broke up with me. Okay, there you have it. And I just decided to go up there, but I still had to make I made 12 poems, first of all, and then I had the orchestrations done separately. I sort of compartmentalized my composition process, really, to try and make sure that stuff will stand up the test of time and stand up the test of your own kind of analysis afterwards, because it can drive you crazy.
Always the great inspiration for music, the proverbial breakup. We want to get one more song in, Julie Feeney and her band performing again tonight at Joe's Pub, but right now they're performing live on Soundcheck, and here's another song from Pages. This is called Stay.
Stay, just stay. inside you is much bigger. There's a little fire inside you.
Julie Feeney from her brand new, newly released album, Pages, just released in the United States with a beautiful song, Stay. Julie, I want to thank you so much and everybody in your band for coming into Soundcheck today. We really enjoyed the performance.
Thank you, Jacqueline. It's really an honor, I have to say. It's first session in the States.
Have a great time at the show tonight. Thank you.
Thanks a million.
That's all for today. On our next program, an exploration of how artists and performers have been shaped by their teenage musical tastes, and a conversation with Depeche Mode frontman Dave Gahan.
He's a tricky thing, and it brings you lightly. Love's not what you think it should be.
And join us Thursday, June 9th at 8 p.m. for our hip-hop showcase featuring four fresh voices of New York hip-hop, Bisco Smith, Nitty Scott MC, Homeboy Sandman, and Blitz the Ambassador. Tickets are on sale now at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineer today was George Wellington. The program is produced by Katie McPherson and Greta Cohen. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Margaret Bresnahan. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta, in for John Schaefer. Join us again at this time tomorrow for another Soundcheck here on 93.9 FM WNYC.
And it brings you lightly. Love's not what you think it should be, then it sinks to you rightly. Oh, bewildered, looking for a lover, maybe you'll discover a friend to play the knowing glance game. Two spoons of sugar and milk, someone to share the really good and bad.
tricky thing. Adam brings you lightly. Love's not what you think it should be, then it sings to you rightly. Love is a tricky thing, and it brings you lightly. Love's not what you think it should be, then it sings to you rightly.